the stuff gone. What can she say without admitting to theft? She isn't quite right in the head, I reckon, Tom said, waiting on the landing as Swain closed the door. Still, at least the Frenchman will be able to read his menus again. Can't have him putting salt in the custard, poor old chap. It was satisfying, at least, to return the spectacles to the chef. Swain found him in the kitchen in his whites, beating eggs for a sauce. Without a word, he handed him the spectacles. The chef sighed in relief and put them on. The pencil and shirt stud he smiled at in recognition. These I had not even noticed, he said, putting them into his pocket. Thank you, Monsieur Swain. You understand that I could not speak to her about this myself. Yes, and I advise you not to in future either, said the butler. She will face the consequences, but I shall not say anything until after the party. Of course, said Monsieur. I pity her, Monsieur, between you and me, but we cannot allow this to continue. He is wrong in the head, in my opinion, Monsieur said. It is a kind of madness. It is called kleptomanie in French. In English I do not know the word. It is pitiful indeed. Yes, I have come across such things once or twice above stairs. It isn't usually given such a fancy name here below. They just call it thieving and send you up before the magistrates. Let's get the party over with, and then we can see what can be done about Miss Hartley. Chapter 20. The salon was aglow. Candlelight reflected on the gilded plasterwork of the ceiling, casting the softest light over every surface in the room. By day, the elaborate mouldings of swathed fruits and flowers looked cracked in places and a little shabby, but they were transformed by the light of the fires at either end of the long room and the chandeliers all along its length. This was Pemberton Hall at its grandest. The guests in their finery made a spectacle worthy of their elegant setting. The gentlemen in evening dress, the ladies in silks with feathered headpieces, pearls, diamonds, and tiaras. Rich floral perfumes of rose, honeysuckle, and jasmine filled the air, scenting the winter's night like a summer garden. The two aunts were on a sofa near the front. When they saw Vita, they patted a chair beside them to summon their interpreter to their side. Such a lovely dress you have, Vita, Tante Adelina whispered. Gabriella agreed. Indeed, yes, she said. Most suitable, Miss Carew. Our German fashions are a little different, however. Alexander was already at the grand piano when Carlotta entered, spectacular in a rosy pink gown that fell low on her shoulders and trailed a lacy train behind. She was a different young woman now, a confident professional. With no sign of self-consciousness or hesitation, she smiled and nodded briefly at the room, then took her place near the piano. Everyone sat forward with murmurs of expectation. Alexander played a brief introduction, and Carlotta von Diepenthal began the first song. Lottie's fine soprano was a revelation to Vita, who had sat through many evenings of singing to the piano at home in Devon. Her father's neighbours and friends loved a musical evening. Several of the ladies and one or two of the gentlemen farmers and other men of the church were fancied as having fine singing voices, but as she listened, Vita realised they were like sparrows to a nightingale. The singers Vita had heard before sounded musical and pleasant. Sometimes they even made the words of a song seem moving. But Lottie's singing reached into the listener's heart with a purity and power that was overwhelming. Vita was prepared for skill and mastery of technique. Carlotta was an esteemed singer with an international reputation after all. But neither Vita nor the other English guests were prepared for the way the soprano's voice seemed to speak directly to their souls. Tears ran down many cheeks. In short, it took only a few bars of the first song before the whole audience fell under the spell of a beautiful voice giving a great performance. The servants, though not invited as guests, had an unusually good view of the performance too. Pemberton had been altered 100 years before. The famous architect had chopped rooms up, added stairways, raised ceilings, and generally redesigned the old place. One of the results of his efforts was that a landing on the back stairs ended up going nowhere, blocked by the end wall of the new salon. At some point, a small window was opened from this landing. Concealed from the salon by a moulding, it offered a clear, if distant, view from just below ceiling level of the whole room. Very few social events of any importance passed at Pemberton without an audience of servants viewing from this secret place. Usually they were too busy to do more than take a few moments to glance and admire the dresses of the ladies or the dancing before hurrying back to the kitchens. But this evening, a row of 3 chairs had been placed, and most of the staff from below stairs took their turn to listen to the famous soprano. But Miss Hartley, the only staff member who knew opera and had followed the careers of both Alexander and Carlotta with passionate interest, did not join them. Chapter 21. In the housekeeper's pantry, Eunice Parks, cup of tea in hand, lowered herself into her favourite armchair, and with the sigh of someone who had been on her feet for many hours, lifted her worn but well-polished boots onto the padded fender. Closing her eyes, she allowed the glow of the fire to play over her face. The kitchens were near enough to hear the bustle of preparations, and the smell of roasting meats made its way across the flagstone servants' corridor, but none of that was her concern. A house full of guests, most of them foreigners, who didn't speak the language and had all manner of strange and unexpected requirements. The German doctor wanted his mattress moved to the floor, had been installed in spring-cleaned and newly aired rooms. Bags had been unpacked, clothes hung, refreshed, ironed, and returned. None of the housemaids had dropped or broken anything, and none of the footmen had left a valise in the wrong room. In short, the long-planned grand event was smoothly underway. This moment, as the company listened to the concert, was one of the rare and treasured pauses in Mrs. Parks's long, long day. Later, there would be beds to be turned down, fires to be tended, demands for bedding, hot water bottles, who knew what else. But now, for a few precious moments, the housekeeper's time was her own. The gentle strains of a fine soprano filtered down the stone back stairs. A harp accompanied the angelic sound, just as in heaven, Eunice thought, though perhaps in heaven her feet wouldn't be so sore. Her cup and saucer, pretty but unmatched, began to tilt. A log shifted on the fire. One melody gave way to another upstairs, and Mrs. Parks's head began to sink towards her left shoulder. But if she dozed, she did so with the long-time housekeeper's permanent alertness. She was awake and on her feet by the time the youngest footman got up his courage and knocked a second time. "Very sorry to disturb you, Mrs. Parks. Only it's Miss Hartley," he said when she opened the door. "Nettie says there's noises coming from her room." Dear God, not now, Mrs. Parks thought, straightening her laced collar. Not during the concert. "Go back to Mr. Swain," she told the boy. "I shall see to Miss Hartley." The housekeeper hurried along the corridor to the back staircase. Irritation sharpened the tap of her boots on the worn flagstones. Miss Lardy Dar Hartley was up to her old nonsense, was she? The housekeeper's eyes, as always, scanned for dust, cobwebs, misplaced objects, or stray candle wax as she passed. She straightened a ball of roses on the landing, scarcely breaking her step. The wretched woman had made a nuisance of herself for months, she thought, stopping to listen for passing guests. It did not do for a hurrying housekeeper to take an aristocratic lady or gentleman by surprise. A housekeeper should radiate calm at all times. She should tread lightly in the corridors of the great house. Ideally, she should be invisible. She should certainly never stomp, rush, or lose her temper, the very idea. Mrs. Parks tried not to grit her teeth. She had predicted trouble. Miss Hartley had been leading up to something with her aches and pains, her medicines, her special food. Mrs. Parks had seen such things before. She had seen them even in governesses, a breed more prone than most to nervous attacks and fits of strange behaviour, and above all else, to giving themselves airs and having fancy ideas. But why, if Miss Hartley was to create a drama, did the dratted woman have to choose such an occasion to do it? Miss Hartley needed a proper talking to. Down the long bedroom corridor bustled Mrs. Parks, still alert for dust or imperfection, until she reached the discreet door in the panelling at the end that led up the back stairs to the nursery landing. Here, the Turkey rugs of the bedroom corridor gave way to bare boards and oilcloth, though the passage was well lit and wallpapered to match the nursery rooms above. The stairs twisted, emerging near the children's bedrooms. The governess's room was a little further along, beyond the schoolroom and nursery kitchen. Mrs. Parks listened at young Master William's bedroom door, but heard no sound. Nettie, the nursery maid, was at her mending in the nursery kitchen. She sprang to her feet, always nervous, at the senior woman's approach. Mrs. Parks was famously fierce, and Nettie at 15 lived in fear of her sharp tongue. "What's all this, Nettie?"
"It's Miss Hartley, Mrs. Parks. She was making a lot of noise. Master William was in the playroom, and he was worried, poor lad. I told him it was nothing, but it was horrible."
"What kind of noise?"
"We could hear banging and bumping. I thought she was moving the furniture about, but when I listened at the door, I could hear her moaning and making sounds. She might be ill, Mrs. Parks. I was too scared to go in. I called to her, but she didn't answer. I didn't want to worry Master William. You know what he's like. He gets nightmares as it is."
"Did you send him somewhere else?"
"Yes, I told both the boys to play in the long corridor until bedtime."
"You stay here. Send anyone who comes away. I shall look in on Miss Hartley myself." Chapter 22. When Miss Hartley did not answer a knock at her door, Mrs. Parks pressed her ear to it and rapped more loudly. "Miss Hartley, it's Mrs. Parks. Are you asleep?" The housekeeper pressed her ear to the door but heard nothing. A queasy feeling crept into her stomach. She wondered whether to call for help. Swain was always reliable in an emergency, but dinner preparations would be well underway. She pictured the long formal dining table, shining with silver. Swain checking the place settings with his measure. He could not possibly come away. Mrs. Parks turned her passkey in the lock and pushed, but the door did not open. It moved a little as if something were against it. She pushed again and the door yielded an inch or two. Whatever was against the door on the inside was soft, not a piece of furniture, for example. Pushing a third time, Mrs. Parks looked down to see what was blocking her way and caught a glimpse of soft fabric near the foot of the door. It was a scalloped edging, as you would see on a petticoat. Mrs. Parks allowed the door to close again and turned her back to it, gathering herself. Her immediate thought was this: the wretched woman is drunk. She has fallen over behind the door. Cursing all intemperance, the housekeeper turned back to the door and threw her whole weight against it several times. The governess was lying on her side. Her eyes were half closed and her mouth was open. It was particularly shocking to Mrs. Parks to see that Miss Hartley, neat, prim Miss Hartley, had her clothes crushed in rumpled disarray and her hair wild and askew. Her skin was waxen, her lips tinged blue. Her dress was rucked up, showing thin legs and rumpled drawers beneath wrinkled petticoats. The housekeeper stood for a few moments, looking down at the fallen woman and taking in the details of the room around her. The bed was tidily made. There were no empty glasses or signs of drinking. A single book had fallen to the floor, and a chair near the door lay on its side. A tinkling Mozart air drifted into the governess's room from downstairs, and with it a murmur of laughter and the distant hum of the concert underway downstairs. Steeling herself, Mrs. Parks reached to touch the hand that lay nearest on the rug. It was chilled, but so was the room. There was no fire in the grate. Mrs. Parks shivered. She could see her own breath before her in the dim room. With a grunt of effort, she knelt and put her cheek to the blue lips. Was there movement in the chest? Did she feel a breath against her cheek? By now, the sound of her own pounding heart and the utter confusion of her thoughts made it impossible to know. Mrs. Parks struggled back to her feet and, stepping back, leaned against the wall, breathing hard. She studied the faded primroses on the wallpaper, running her fingers briefly along their intertwining stems. When she moved again, her manner was purposeful. She emerged from the governess's room a few minutes later. Locking the door behind her, she turned briskly, straightened her posture, smoothed her skirts, tucked her hair back into its bun, and walked back along the passage to the nursery kitchen. "Nettie, Miss Hartley is unwell. I've settled her in bed, and I shall visit her again in a little while. You will have to take over her duties. Help Miss Marianne to undress later. Sleep in the room opposite Master William's tonight. I shall send Jeanie to help you at bedtime. Is that understood?" "Yes, Mrs. Parks," said Nettie, bobbing a curtsy. "And Nettie, we do not want to disturb the children or spoil the party, so it would be best to say nothing about this. Do you understand?" "Yes, Mrs. Parks. But what if I hear her cry out again? Will I send for you?"
"Ring the bell. I will come myself," the housekeeper said. Nettie thought this unusually kind.
Chapter 23. It could never be confessed in polite company, but Vita's education had left her with a blank spot where music was concerned. She'd been to concerts and sung in church, of course, but when her friends passed happy afternoons playing the piano, the flute or the violin, Vita could only watch in admiration, whilst often surreptitiously reading a book. Knowing nothing about it made her, if anything, a better audience member, for she was easily impressed. Her sensitivity had not been blunted by overexposure. Where someone with detailed knowledge might listen critically and hear faults or misinterpretations, Vita was easily transported with delight. Her imagination conjured up stories to explain the music. Now he is galloping through the woods, now she is in a rage and running through the storm. She was impressed, as the truly ignorant are, by all the wrong things. How amazing that Lottie can hold her breath for so long. How astonishing that she can remember the words. Dramatic German songs, often about long journeys which end badly, were not her favourite. But the operatic arias, so passionate, so heartfelt, brought tears to her eyes. And in all this, she was far from alone. When the performance was at an end,
An enormous armful of flowers was presented to Lottie by a beaming and proprietorial Signor Ricci. He had sprung from his chair, roaring bravo and encore, and urged two additional songs from the pair already. As the cheering and applause finally faded, Alexander stepped forward. He gestured for silence and took Lottie's hand in his, bringing it to his lips. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "thank you. And to add to our festivities this evening, I am delighted to announce that Miss von Diepenthal has done me the great honour of accepting my proposal. Carlotta and I are engaged to be married." This, of course, brought a surge of applause and enthusiasm from the audience. The German aunts on either side beamed and tapped their folded fans. Vita looked across and saw Lady Pemberton smile in a gracious acknowledgement of the news. Lord Pemberton, in his chair, nodded before Billings wheeled him away. A gong sounded above the hubbub, and Swain announced dinner. As the guests, in high spirits, began to move towards the dining room, Vita saw Signor Ricci dart towards Carlotta. Smiling and nodding most charmingly, he blocked her way. Alexander's hand was being shaken by almost every man in the room. He was swept into the crowd. His fiancée, though, was gently detained by the Italian. Leaving the salon with the German aunts, Vita noticed how serious Carlotta's expression had suddenly become. "Such delicious smells," Gabrielle remarked. "Wonderful music always brings a good appetite, does it not?" Beneath the chandeliers of the long parlour, footmen were weaving between the guests, serving glasses of champagne. A string quartet struck up, the harpist filling the air with silvery ribbons of plucked harmony. The German aunts were drawn immediately into one excited group after another, congratulated and praised on all sides for their niece's talents and the happy announcement of the engagement. Vita, observing from a corner, noticed that the sea of colourful noise and movement was hazier than usual and realised she must have left her spectacles in the salon. She slipped back across the hall to find them. Faced with ranks of empty chairs, it took Vita a few moments to locate the place she had occupied. Even then, she could only peer around, suffering the usual irritating difficulty of needing glasses to find lost glasses. She was on the floor behind a sofa feeling about when she heard Lottie and Signor Ricci approach. Their conversation was hushed and intense. "Alas, Miss Diepenthal, my sopranos are always single ladies. It is an iron rule with me. Marriage must wait until the world has taken a newcomer to its heart. People have to fall in love a little. You understand? Alexander and I have yet to set a date, Signor Ricci," Lottie said as they passed. "A long engagement would be perfectly possible." Her tone was sweetly persuasive. "Alas, even knowing a singer is engaged to be married is too much of a disadvantage."
"I did not know this."
"How could you?" "I only wish it were not so. Don't look sad. The world of the great performer is a harsh one. Many sacrifices are called for. You have made your choice. I adore your voice. I believe, as I said, that I could have taken you to the very heights, but you know your own heart."
"You will dine with us, Signor Ricci, surely?"
"Alas, no. I am expected in London tonight." Vita's hand fell at last onto her lost spectacles, and she stood up just as Lottie and Signor Ricci passed the door of the salon, and the rest of their talk was lost in the music beyond. Chapter 24. Cook always thought that from downstairs in the kitchens, a large dinner party sounded like the rumble of a long storm. She rarely left the kitchens at such a time, as she was orchestrating the final stages of cooking. Monsieur, in his tall white hat, stationed near the stairs, used by the servers, supervised the presentation of each finished dish. Under his scrutiny, no dab of misplaced sauce, no wrongly shaped carrot, misgrilled fillet, or under-seasoned souffle could reach the dining room. Although only the muted rumble of polite conversation, studded with an occasional crescendo of laughter, reached as far as the kitchens, chef and cook were both expert at interpreting the sounds of the dining room overhead. Conversation would begin quietly over the first two courses, but as the wine flowed and the company relaxed into the pleasures of the table, and these pleasures were considerable in this household, the volume of collected voices rose with each successive course. By the time desserts and fruit were being eaten, surges of laughter were louder and frequent enough to roll around overhead like summer thunder. These were the sounds the kitchen staff hoped for. They rated a dinner party a success when would-be speechmakers had to tap their spoons on their crystal glasses insistently several times before they could call for silence and begin. Their other source of information was the waiting staff. Swain and his footman, who carried the food and attended the table, whilst hurrying to keep dishes warm, would deliver brief reports on how the food was being received above. "Did they enjoy the poussin?" cook would ask. "Went down a treat," Albert or Tom would reply, lifting the next laden salver from the table near the stairs. "And his lordship? Did he like the new sauce?" I saw him give Swain the nod. A nod from the master or mistress to Swain was the sign of highest approval. Seated at either end of the table, Lady Felicity in particular used a series of subtle signs to time the courses and indicate pleasure or displeasure. Waiting footmen, standing to attention in their livery around the table, watched carefully, trying to detect the code, but Swain kept the details to himself. Suffice to say that Swain at any moment knew precisely how the host and hostess wanted the dinner to proceed, whether it was satisfactory, whether more wine or less should be served, which guest might require more attention, which dishes were particularly enjoyed, and when each course was over and the next should be brought in. This dinner was rather late to begin. In the kitchens, chef and cook were anxiously delaying the moment of readiness for the first dishes, but they knew this was generally a good sign. It meant people were enjoying their conversation over the champagne in the salon, and Lady Felicity did not feel the need to hasten them through to the dining room. By the time grace had been said, in German, Swain reported, and the company was seated and ready to begin, both chef and cook were eager to serve, so the soups, a mock turtle and the delicate consommé, were into the tureens and being ladled into dishes very rapidly. "What if the Germans don't know the French words on the menu?" Mrs. Dobbs wondered. "How will they know which soup they want?" "They know French too. All German people know French," Alfred, the nearest footman, said. "The German lady told me." "Which German lady, Alfred? What are you doing talking to German ladies?" "The famous one, the opera lady, Miss von Watzet. She came into the serving room just now. Very polite she was. She came to thank us for making her and her aunts welcome. She had a good look round. She said she liked the look of the soups." "Well, I never," said Mrs. Dobbs. "I imagine German people understand a French menu in the way that English people do, which is to say not very well," Mr. Picard remarked, once Alfred had left with a heavy tray. "But these are educated people, so perhaps they know more than most." "I should not like to eat a dinner without knowing what any of it was," cook said, straightening a prawn that was out of place on the layered pyramid display of seafood being prepared for the next course. At least with the seafood, you can see what you're getting. Can't mistake an oyster for anything else, even if you are a foreigner. Begging your pardon, Monsieur Picard. The dinner sounds from overhead were slightly different tonight, she thought, as she checked the ice in the buckets of oysters that had been brought in from the storeroom. The company seemed particularly merry. That would be the happy occasion of the engagement. But the collected voices were deeper than usual. German men had deeper voices than the usual English company, she concluded, uncertain whether this was a good thing or a bad thing. At first, the seafood course went well. There was, a footman reported, a murmur of admiration round the table as the sumptuous displays of shellfish were brought to table. English diners, being brought up to believe it bad-mannered to pay attention to food, never reacted in this way. The German guests had no such inhibitions and showed their delight by tucking napkins under their chins and setting energetically about the glistening oysters, lobster and prawns. Lady Felicity, who didn't much care for seafood herself, watched with approval as the beautifully constructed towers of shellfish were rapidly reduced to piles of shells, feelers, spidery legs and torn-off beady-eyed heads. Footmen rapidly swept them into silver buckets and bore them away. Chapter 25. Preoccupied as she was with preparing duck and quail for the next course, cook only gradually noticed a change in the sound from the dining room. An unexpected hush had fallen. A murmur of conversation followed, but its tone was different. As she moved to another hot plate and began stirring the sauce for the venison, she thought she heard a slight disturbance, perhaps a chair falling, and then many voices in tones that distinctly suggested alarm. Monsieur, on the other side of the kitchen, was aligning an array of his delicate pastries on their stands and caught her eye. Both stopped what they were doing and looked towards the kitchen stairs, expecting a footman to come down and tell them what had happened. Both at this point imagined a minor domestic difficulty, a spillage perhaps, something that might delay the other courses but cause no other harm. No footman came. Cook, increasingly aware of the unusual sounds coming from the dining room, looked about the kitchen and realized the three kitchen maids had all stopped what they were doing. They were looking at her in alarm. "What's going on, cook?" Annie, the scullery maid, asked. "Back to your work, Annie, please," said Mrs. Dobbs. "Mr. Swain will send George or Tom down in a minute." Monsieur Picard was closest to the kitchen stairs, but he had returned to the delicate placement of tarts and iced pastries on their stands. "Shall I send Jeanie up to see if there is to be a delay, Monsieur Picard? I don't want those duck breasts overcooked." "Yes, if her sauce will not burn," said Monsieur. Jeanie, the senior kitchen maid, a level-headed girl, removed her apron and dried her hands. "Just look into the dining room from the serving room, Jeanie, and see if we need to delay the next course. Perhaps one of the ladies has fainted," Mrs. Dobbs suggested as Jeanie hurried past. Somewhere upstairs, a door opened, and for a few seconds, the sound of the dining room washed over the landing and down into the kitchen at full volume. They heard shouts, running footsteps, urgent cries. By now, nobody in the kitchen was concentrating on the food. As one, they looked towards the stairs. A long moment passed, during which sauces steamed and duck breasts continued to hiss in the pan. And then, with a clatter of boots, Jeanie rushed back down to the kitchen. She was pale and breathless with the shock of what she had seen. "They're sick, Mrs. Dobbs, lots of them. The young German lady has fallen down, and they don't know if she's breathing. They were all crowded round. Swain says Annie should bring buckets. They've sent for Dr. Mills. One of the German men is a doctor too. It's terrible, Mrs. Dobbs. They're all running about. The ladies are crying out for help and everyone is frantic."
and the master and mistress. They were helping the young German lady. I think she might be dying, Mrs. Dobbs. Jeanie gasped for breath and pressed her hands to her face. Tears began to run between her fingers. We'll need to put the kettle on in case anyone wants tea, Mrs. Dobbs said, and bustled to do it herself, comforted by a familiar activity among this sudden breakdown of normality.
We shall suspend service, Mrs. Dobbs. Do you agree? Said Monsieur Picard.
I do agree. Shall we move what's ready to the hot cupboard upstairs in the serving room?
No. We must keep the other food away from the dining room, said the chef. His face looked strange to Mrs. Dobbs. His complexion was grey, and even the way he stood made him seem suddenly older.
He pulled his tall chef's toque from his head and walked through the kitchens, past the pantry and stores, and out of the back door into the yard. Chapter 26. The German doctor among the guests that night, Herr Dr. Julius Zecker, was a skin specialist. It had been many years since he had practiced any sort of medicine except the prescribing of coloured ointments and herbal baths. Before becoming personal physician to the von Diepenthals, his practice had been in a spa town, favoured by wealthy widows, who were inclined to adopt dear Dr. Zecker and consult him long after their condition had healed. Julius Zecker was a vegetarian and a natural aesthete. He believed in long walks in all weathers, did not touch alcohol or coffee, and preferred to sleep, though his patients did not know this, on the floor at night. He had a passion for English country house architecture. A large part of the reason he accepted the invitation to this party was to see Pemberton Hall's Palladian exterior and rotunda for himself. He hoped to visit other country houses in the area. Combining his two great interests, building and medicine, he was developing a theory about the effect of different architectural styles on health. His early thesis was that bodily health was greatly strengthened and sustained by symmetry, though whether symmetry of straight line or curve was more effective, he had yet to ascertain. Dr. Zecker's first reaction, when the sickness set in around him, was fervently to wish himself elsewhere. However, his training soon asserted itself, and by the time it was clear that the evening would not be proceeding as planned, he was directing servants to assist guests who had been taken ill, and helping Carlotta as best he could. Carlotta was the first and the most violently affected. She had risen suddenly from the table soon after the shellfish displays had been presented, and struggling to take a step or two toward the door, appeared to have fainted. The first reaction around the table had been mild concern only. A lady fainting was not, after all, so very rare. But Carlotta had then woken and almost immediately begun to vomit with such repeated violence that the doctor had hurried over, and the whole table had stopped eating in horror. Within moments, two or three other guests had begun to retch and try to rise from their seats, but the violence of the onset of the sickness caused them to fall to the ground, helpless. Soon a third of the guests were indisposed, and the others were paralysed either by horror or by their own nausea. Swain and his footman ran from one group to the next, but could do little more than proffer cushions, bowls, or cloths. Those who had collapsed around the table were too weak to be moved at first. Under the directions of the German doctor, they were lifted and propped around the walls. The clothing around their necks was loosened, and their faces were bathed with cooling water between bouts of sickness. Those who were not affected he ordered out of the dining room, directing them to retire to their own rooms and stay there. If they felt unwell, they were to call for assistance, but not to mix with other guests. Although every early indication suggested poisoning, Dr. Zecker could not rule out a contagion of some sort this early. In case this was an infection, he wanted as many guests as possible isolated. Besides,
It lessened the pandemonium in the dining room. Vita had watched in alarm as the scene unfolded. She had been preoccupied when the shellfish first appeared, with Lottie's two aunts. Over the soup, they had begun discussing gardening, a topic for which Vita had prepared one or two conversational starters, such as, "Do you favour the formal style of garden or the more informal?" But very little progress had been made because both old ladies were enthusiastic about their dinner and wanted the menu translated. This ought to have been straightforward, but Vita had not allowed for the complication of mock turtle soup, which took a lot of explaining. Both aunts eventually liked the sound of it and were relieved that no turtles were involved. "The chicken looks very weak to me. I prefer a strong soup," Tanta Gabriella remarked. "Vita, you should choose it too. She will have this one also," she directed the footman. The aunts, perhaps because of their long experience in life, seemed less shaken by the sudden onset of illness all around them than many of the other guests. For practical reasons, from their seats even the nearest shellfish pyramid was out of reach, they had not been quick to begin the next course. Lottie collapsed almost as soon as the footman had served the old ladies, and this was such a distraction that neither had touched oysters or crayfish, so both were soon guided safely to their bedrooms. Once they were settled, Vita came back to see what she could do to help downstairs. Chapter 27. Dr. Mills arrived within an hour of Lottie's collapse. Mills was the local man who had tended to the Pemberton family for years. Some thought him a little old-fashioned, but such doubts were as nothing at a time like this. As the German guests clung to Herr Dr. Zecker, so the English hosts felt better the moment Albert Mills's worn riding boots clumped up the broad curve of the stairs. Lady Pemberton introduced the two medical men in the dining room and watched warily as one would watch two dogs meeting in a park. With Vita translating, Dr. Zecker explained the onset of the illness and what he had done so far. Mills listened and in general seemed to agree. The two doctors moved from patient to patient, taking pulses and feeling foreheads for fever. Mills, a portly man, found bending down to patients on the floor very inconvenient, so left that to his younger colleague. The dining room was a little calmer now. One by one, guests recovered sufficiently to be helped first onto chairs and then to their rooms. Vita walked two or three of them back, helped by a maid or a footman, and assisted the guests to their own beds, where the doctors visited, making rounds, as if in a particularly comfortable hospital. By midnight, most patients were either sleeping peacefully or sipping chamomile tea and feeling a little better. Through the night, the doctors continued their visits, but by dawn it was clear that only Carlotta's condition remained serious. She had been carried by two willing footmen to her room and remained feverish, drifting in and out of consciousness throughout the night. Both her aunts stayed at her bedside, bathing her forehead and speaking to her gently by turns. Alexander tried to visit several times, but was only allowed to glance at the patient from the door, the aunts convinced that all stimulation was to be avoided. He paced the corridor outside the room at first, later dozing occasionally on a chair. By morning he had still not changed out of his dress suit from the night before, but the stiff shirt front was buckled, and one side of the collar had come adrift. His hair stood out from his head, and the pallor of his face and dark circles under his eyes made him look alarming enough for Swain to lead him firmly back to his room for at least a change of clothing. Mills spent the night at Pemberton Hall, and both doctors were back with their patients for an early round soon after 7. They were accompanied by Vita, who was already indispensable to both doctors. At the height of the outbreak, it was Vita who kept a sheet of notes on each patient, carried them boiled water to drink, soothed them by bathing their faces and hands, noted their temperature. Apart from that,
She saw when the doctors were tired, sending for food and drink to sustain them, specifying vegetarian food and herbal tea for Dr. Zecker. The two anxious aunts were persuaded from Lottie's bedside to take a little rest and sustenance themselves, only with a promise that Vita and Dr. Zecker would take their places and send for them the moment there was any change in the patient's condition. By 8, Zecker found that Lottie's fever had begun to decline. She seemed calmer and fell into a normal sleep. "I shall go and tell her aunts," Zecker told her. "I gave them my solemn word I would do so, and they will be cheered by this improvement." "Yes, by all means," Vita said. "I shall wait here." "There would be no harm in sleeping a little in the chair, Miss Carew. There seems to be no danger of a sudden change now, and we medical people must learn to sleep whenever the chance arises, I think." Vita felt pleased to be included in the category of medical people. She stayed at the bedside, but did allow herself to sit back in her chair and relax for the first time in many hours. Her eyes were almost closed when she registered a change in the patient. Lottie blinked and looked around. "Is nobody there?" she asked quietly. Vita realized that the chair she was sitting in was out of the patient's sight, hidden by the draperies around the bed. She was about to answer when Lottie continued speaking drowsily, apparently to herself. "Bravo, Lottie," the young woman in the bed said. "A fine performance, one of your best, but so tiring." She yawned and stretched. "And obviously one has to miss breakfast, which is a great shame." Was Lottie delirious? She did not seem delirious. She seemed conscious. Vita wondered what she should do. Alexander put his head around the door and called in a stage whisper, "Miss Carew, may I come in?" He was already inside the room, stepping anxiously toward the bed, but stopped halfway, seeming unable to bring himself to approach any further. "How is she?" "She seems a little better now," Vita said, still not certain of what she had heard. "May I approach?" "Yes, there is nothing to worry about." Alexander came to the other side of the bed and looked searchingly at the lovely young woman, for Carlotta was beautiful even in sickness, her hair a loose mass of soft honey-brown strands twisting about the pillow and around her face. She now appeared deeply asleep. "Oh, Lottie, my poor Lottie," he said. "I am so sorry. Please forgive me." The patient slept on, her breathing calm and steady. "This is my fault," Alexander said to Vita. "It was I who urged Mama to serve shellfish. It is all my doing. Lottie told me that she loved shellfish and oysters in particular. She had only tried them once in Paris, and she had adored them. I took it into my head to put them on the menu for this dinner. It was a last-minute decision. I had to persuade Mama because of the cost, but she agreed and sent Monsieur Picard to find oysters at 2 days' notice, which he did, all to please Lottie. It was a foolish whim, I see that now. I hold myself entirely responsible for this dreadful accident. And to think that it nearly killed dear Lottie, I can hardly bear the thought." Vita did not know what to say to this. The logic was faulty, but she could tell that logical argument alone would not make Alexander feel better. "She is far stronger now," she told him, but he was not to be comforted. "She may never forgive me," he said. "I fear I have destroyed her health and our happiness. Oh, Lottie, what have I done?" Alexander whispered and left the room without another word. Chapter 28. For several moments, all that could be heard was the peaceful breathing of the patient and birdsong outside the window. The curtains were closed, and Vita was considering opening them a little when footsteps in the corridor warned her of a hastening approach. Swain, the butler, opened the door. He stepped inside and held it behind him. "Miss Carew, the German doctor would like you to come and speak for him. There has been..."
Here his words failed him, but his expression alone was enough to tell Vita something dreadful was amiss. I have asked a maid to sit with Miss Diepenthal until her aunt's return. She will be here soon. Please come immediately. I will meet you at the main stairs. As soon as the maid arrived, Vita hurried along the corridor. Swain was at the staircase and wordlessly led her up to the nursery rooms. There he suddenly stopped short. To warn you, Miss Carew, there has been a discovery. Vita could not help looking around the butler towards the open doorway. It was Miss Hartley's room. She could hear the voices of both doctors. She looked at Swain in alarm. Is it Miss Hartley? She asked.
It is, miss. I'm afraid she was found this morning.
Found? You mean she is ill?
I'm afraid she has been found dead, miss. I regret to tell you so suddenly, but the doctors asked that you be called. They want someone to write their observations down for them. I did offer to do this myself, but they said you were used to them and you have the language. I hope this is not too upsetting.
Miss Hartley is dead? I can hardly believe it, Vita said.
But she followed Swain to the open door of the governess's room. The doctors both turned and looked at Vita. They had been bent over a figure on the bed. Even from the door, Vita could see the figure was lifeless. It was distressing to see the expression on the face of the dead woman, who appeared anguished. Her mouth was open and her lips pulled back in an ugly grin. The teeth, Vita could not help but see, were very poor, some brown and others darker, particularly towards the back. Several were missing.
Miss Carew, you have helped us very efficiently so far. Would you be willing and able to continue now, as we examine this poor woman? I am keen to begin, and Dr. Zecker and I are agreed that someone needs to take notes. Of course, I shall perfectly understand if... Mills was saying. But Vita interrupted.
I am willing to assist. I only need to find paper and a pen. She looked around, but none was obvious in the governess's bare room.
The schoolroom. There'll be some in the schoolroom.
This was Mrs. Parks from a corner of the room. The housekeeper crossed the corridor and quickly returned with an empty exercise book and a pencil. Her hands shook as she gave them to Vita and backed away.
If I am no longer needed here, I shall leave you for now, she muttered, and they heard her hastening footsteps down the corridor.
She was very shocked, Zecca said.
It was she who found her. I was in my room and heard her scream.
I will begin a thorough examination with a view to establishing the cause of death, Mills said, interrupting. If you could just make notes of what I say, Miss Carew, agreed?
Vita translated and the German doctor agreed.
May I ask why she is so rigid? It is not usual, is it? Vita said to Mills, as he hung his tweed jacket on the back of a chair and began rolling up his shirt sleeves. The doctor shrugged.
Rigor mortis. It depends on several factors. We don't know enough to say yet. Now write this down, please. The patient was found by the housekeeper at... He hesitated and looked at Dr. Zecker. Can you remember the exact time, Dr. Zecker?
Vita translated.
8:10, approximately, Zecker replied. We were called at 8:17. I looked at my watch.
Vita gave his answer in English and wrote it down.
Yes, the patient was found by the housekeeper at 8:10, and Dr. Zecker arrived a few moments before I did. Both of us took her pulse and carried out the other usual tests for morbidity and pronounced the patient dead at 8:30. I heard the clock strike.
Should we make a note of where she was found? Vita asked.
Yes, we found the patient on the floor between her bed and the door. There appeared to have been a good deal of movement in the throes of death. That is to say, she seemed to have moved around the room. Several items were in disarray and her clothing was caught around her.
Vita wrote the troubling details down as calmly as she could and translated what Mills had said to Dr. Zecker, who nodded.
There were no signs of injury immediately evident. There was some discoloration to the skin, which seemed yellow, and the lips were blue.
I observed a yellowish powder deposited on her lips, Zecker put in. once he heard the translation. I should like that recorded. I made no such observation, Mills said. But he did not object to the German doctor's addition. We both noticed that the body was in a state of rigor mortis, which seemed to have set in some hours before. We shall now need to remove the deceased woman's clothing, Miss Carew. It may not be easy to do so. We may need to cut it. Chapter 29. If Vita had felt sorry for Miss Hartley before, she certainly felt great pity for her now. Her dress and underclothes were cut away to reveal a grey, gaunt body, still clenched in rigour, as angular and pale as a skeleton carved on a marble tomb. Her hair, bunched and sticky, almost covered her face, but not completely enough to hide the disturbing silent shriek she ended her life giving. Dr. Mills, without mentioning it, leaned over and applied enough pressure to close her eyelids. The body is thin. She is considerably underweight. There are old scars, but no recent injuries that I can see. Apart from this, the only abnormality is a light swelling to the left lower jaw. Do you see that, Zecca? The German doctor, once the question was understood, examined the jaw himself. Yes, he said. A dental abscess, I would guess. Mills nodded. When we can open the mouth again, we will establish the cause, but for now we will just note the presence of the swelling. Vita did so. The doctors, together, rolled the body over, but there were no abnormalities to be seen on the woman's back, except that it was thin enough for the bones to show clearly under the skin. My conclusion at this early stage would be that the cause of death was medical. It is unlikely to be food poisoning associated with the cases we attended yesterday. What do you think, Zecca? The German doctor looked at the body in his turn. He examined the fingernails and toes, as well as feeling the neck and head. I can add little to Dr. Mills' conclusions, he said. I would not want to eliminate other causes of death, such as a crisis of the heart or a brain seizure, entirely. But it does not look like poisoning to me. It is unusual for rigor to set in so rapidly. Vita wrote all this into the notes. There was a pause as the doctors covered the body again and did what they could to restore some dignity to the governess by pulling the bed covers awkwardly over her corpse. If I might make a suggestion, it would be helpful, perhaps, to write into the notes a few observations about the room itself, Dr. Zecca told them. I have once before been involved in a police investigation, and they were particularly concerned with this sort of circumstantial detail. No doubt the housekeeper will soon want to set the room to rights, so the moment to make such notes would be now, immediately. Why does he talk of the police? Mills asked, when Vita finished translating. I see no need to involve the police whatsoever. He was rolling down his shirt sleeves. Zecca began a tour of the room, speaking his observations aloud so that Vita could write them down. A rapid survey of the room shows that a small side table, a chair, and a bookshelf have been overturned. There are several books on the floor. The bed is disordered, and the covers are twisted on the floor. The patient had perhaps been entangled in the sheets and dragged them from the bed behind her in a struggle to reach the door. Zecca walked over to the door and bent to study it closely. What is he saying? Mills put in. He seems to be speaking at length. Does this concern me? He is simply recording the condition of the room, the bed, and so on, Vita explained. Mills seemed uninterested in this. Zecca continued. On her nightstand is an empty glass, which has a trace of liquid left in it. We should keep this. It may tell us that she drank something before she died, some medicine or sleeping draught. Ask Dr. Mills, if you would be so kind, whether he himself prescribed any medicines to this governess. Vita did this, Mills, now shrugging his jacket back on, said no at first, then added, I did last year prescribe a tonic, but nothing since.
A tonic? As treatment for what ailment? Zecca asked when he heard this. Vita translated.
Some digestive ailment. I'd have to consult my records to be certain. Miss Hartley was, in general, someone who suffered regular poor health and many minor ailments.
Dr. Zecca continued moving about the room. He looked into a writing desk and slid open the small top drawer in a chest of drawers.
I must say I do not see the point of this prying, Mills remarked. He told Vita to translate this.
Zecca closed the drawer and gave a slight bow of acknowledgement to the senior doctor.
Well, we need not detain you further, Miss Carew. As long as your notes are clear, you have been of important assistance to us, and in a way to the unfortunate Miss Hartley as well, Dr. Mills told Vita. Leave your notes on the table over there, and I shall take charge of them. I shall need to discuss this situation with Lord and Lady Pemberton immediately, as I'm sure you will understand.
Dr. Zecca went over to the bowl of water provided by the bedside and washed his hands. Vita was about to do as Mills asked and leave her notes, but the German doctor looked up and caught her eye. He looked sharply towards the notes in her hand. Without a change of expression, his look conveyed some hint that Vita registered. I have written very hasty notes, gentlemen. If you have finished this first examination, I should like to go and make a fair copy of them before I hand them over. I shall bring you the notes very soon. With that, Vita hurried out of the room, holding the papers close to her chest. In the corridor, Vita found Mrs. Parks leaning as if exhausted against a wall. She looked as if she had been weeping. Have the doctors finished? What did they say? She asked.
They only carried out a general inspection.